And we're about to do something that we don't normally do, but we're delighted to be able to do it today. And this is a special edition of the Infectious Disease Program. We've got Sharon Sanders from Florida on, and then I'm going to let you introduce your guests, Sharon. But we're on the air. Can you all hear me okay?
I'm good.
Good. Well, it's all yours.
Great. Well, we're very pleased today to be able to speak to Dr. Michael Osterholm. He is the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. He's also the director of the NIH-supported Minnesota Center of Excellence for Influenza Research and Surveillance. He's a professor in the Division of Environmental Health Services and an adjunct professor in the medical school at the University of Minnesota. He is known widely in, I guess, pandemic information circles as one of the foremost authorities in the world on pandemic influenza, and a host of related issues. Welcome, Dr. Osterholm.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here with you.
Great. Well, what is your take on what's going on today?
Well, I think we're in a, I guess for a lack of a better term, a very interesting time in that with the H1N1 activity that we see, we find ourselves literally in a influenza pandemic, but unlike one that anyone had imagined might be the next pandemic. And so we see a lot of people adjusting their expectations, their concerns, their plans, and even how we talk about this situation. I think at the same time we're also realizing that the current H1N1 situation could change overnight with any types of mutations, reassortments that might occur with this virus. And before we're all lulled into a complete false sense of security that we have this very mild seasonal flu virus, moving around the world in pandemic fashion, that's how it's going to stay. So I think that we're also trying to make sure that we keep people moving towards better preparedness with the idea that the months ahead are yet a crystal ball yet to be understood.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it matters at this point whether or not we're calling this officially a 5 or a 6? It seems like there's been quite a bit of, discussion about who should declare it a 6. It's really a 6.
Right.
Does it really matter at this point?
Well, in a sense, there is a semantics that goes with this that does matter in the fact that we don't want people to believe that what we were talking about with a phase 6 in the past is what is occurring now. Nor do we want them to believe that this is all you have to do to prepare for what has been called Phase 6 up until now. The WHO is based on, as an organization, its scientific integrity. And if, in fact, they now suddenly say, oh, wait a minute, it's not convenient politically and surely not from a response basis, a mitigation basis, a need to call this a 6, then we won't. When all along, 6 was really all about transmission. It was about the fact that we had a worldwide march of a new novel influenza strain, and that's what we called 6. So I don't really have a concern about what we call it as long as we adequately describe it. What is the incidence of the disease? What is the frequency of severe illness? And how then do we adjust our mitigation strategies in that same light? I think the real concern that we have is we don't get bogged down into a debate about should we or should we not call this a 6, and then miss the point that what's happening out there is important and surely could change in severity, or that we injure the scientific integrity basis by which WHO operates, that there will be times when we need them to make very difficult decisions and very strong public statements about tough issues that are based on science. And once you, in a sense, give away that science platform, you break the integrity of that platform, you really never get it back again. And so we have to make sure that whatever WHO decides to call it in the future, it's based on the best scientific information.
Mm-hmm. They also, of course, are following all the developments with H5N1. And there's some interesting developments along with what you're just talking about now. For instance, Egypt had quite a bit of confirmed activity. I think it's something like 23 cases this year. Yet, there's zero cases reported confirmed by WHO. When they are the leader in, unfortunately, in the number of human cases. What do you think that says for our WHO counting system?
Well, I think that at this point, I wouldn't read much into that at all. I think that the case numbers will be posted. It's a function of an administrative issue of, you know, they're overwhelmed right now with H1N1, so it's not that they're going to be missing these cases. I think it's just a function of when they get posted. The important issue is, are we on top of the H5N1 issue? And when you realize that there has been a resurgence of major avian activity in Shanghai Lake in China, that there appears to be some things happening in Asia that, again, reflect what we may have seen several years ago when this virus very quickly spread throughout Asia and into Europe. Those are things we need to be aware of, and we are, and we're monitoring those things. In fact, our very group right now is in China working on some of these issues. So I think I'd be more concerned not so much about the cases that we know about just have not yet officially been counted, but have we taken our eye off the ball and we're so focused now on H1N1 we're not watching H5N1? And I don't think that's the case. You know, and the other thing I would just remind everyone is we've said many times, maybe there's a third virus out there that ultimately will be the one that will really do us great harm as a worldwide population. You know, maybe H1N1 is going to fizzle away after a few months of circulation, only with mild illness ever being the primary manifestation. And there will be another one that will come along that will really surprise us. You know, H5N1 may never go anywhere beyond this very limited human transmission issue. So I think we have to expect the unexpected, and we have to be prepared for it. And I think right now, on a whole, I feel confident that most of the H5N1 activity is being captured.
How do you feel the world's responding to the stage 5 that was called by WHO? Do you feel that the countries are preparing more? Is this filtering down into, you know, the communities, the corporations, and then, you know, into the individual level? How do you feel that actually the world's doing pandemic preparedness?
Yeah, that one I wish I could give you a better answer. And I'd like to be able to tell you that it is better out there than it really is, and I'm afraid it's not. I think there are several things that have happened. First is that we did see a resurgence of activity around pandemic preparedness in those first 10 days after the first recognition of H1N1. And then when it kind of became a yawner, when in a sense it wasn't a severe disease picture that everyone feared, I think we almost may have set ourselves back a bit because people then said, well, if this is it, hey, this is it. It's not so bad. And in a sense, there was this idea that some of us, again, were crying wolf, that, you know, there really isn't a major preparedness need here. We got through this just fine. I think that would be a really unfortunate takeaway message from this experience. If you look at what happened, though, even in those first 10 days, there were valuable lessons that said how unprepared we were. We had a number of hospitals in this country that ran out of respirators and face masks that were being used. We saw that around the world. And it pointed out an underlying issue that our group has been working long and hard on, and that is global supply chains for many, many critical products and services that we count on, medications, things like masks, respirators, vaccines even. And we still are very ill-prepared for that. We live in a global just-in-time economy that's based on no inventory, no warehousing to keep the cost per unit as cheap as possible. And had this particular situation persisted for a few more weeks and there had been more widespread illness in many of the developing countries of the world where these products originate from, and there had there been any border crossing interruptions, we would have been in a world of hurt very quickly. And I don't see anything from this experience that kind of stuck out as a learning lesson moment for people. They, if anything, they think we got through it. Don't worry, we got through it. And again, had this persisted for just even a couple more weeks, I think it would have been a very different situation in terms of that we had hospitals within the first week running out of respirators already, and this was supposed to be their six-month stockpile.
What's the remedy for this? You know, the U.S. government has been sort of beating this drum for a few years. You've been very active for years and years. WHO did just go through up the stages, two stages in a row. The media did really get on the bandwagon with the swine flu issue, and it seems like things are settling down. You know, what can be done to still make people aware of the fact that, you know, if anything now, we're looking at maybe a return of an H1N1 in the fall
yeah.
that may have some extra goodies on it that aren't so great.
You know, I think you did a great job of almost summing up the question and the answer together. We have to continue to push forward this idea that we need more resilience in the system. We've got to have it. And just start to track some of these critical products and services I just talked about. We just did a study where we've looked at critical drugs that we need in this country. Otherwise, people die. Meaning these are not the kind of like cancer drugs where you need them within days to weeks. But today, if you didn't have this drug, people would die. If we didn't have insulin today, if we didn't have those things on the crash cart in the emergency room. And in our studies, identifying roughly 30 such drugs, almost all of those are produced offshore, and the supply chains are very long and thin. And if there is anything that interrupts international trade and travel, which I think pandemic influenza has one of the highest likelihoods of doing that of any of the Mother Nature-made related events, and for that matter, even against some of the man-made related events like war and terrorism, we have to understand what that means. Imagine we're not going to be sitting here debating whether or not we have enough ventilators, but what if we didn't have enough insulin and we had otherwise healthy people who couldn't get enough? That's the kind of thing that I think that really is going to be important for us to have more discussions about, how would we look at allocating those resources, and we just haven't done that yet. And if anything, we just need to remind our governments and our private sector companies that if we don't do that, we will do it when a severe pandemic occurs, and that's not the time to be making those kinds of decisions. So you know, we're not out of the woods yet on this one, but even if we are out of the woods, any planning that we put into a more severe pandemic will never be wasted.
How do you feel that our vaccine situation is developing on H1N1?
Well, I think that you know, the governments of the world have really moved forward quickly with the companies to develop seed stock and to begin looking at the mass production of vaccine material. That's still a far cry from actually putting it in people, finding out what the appropriate dosages would be, and then actually packaging it for delivery to an individual, meaning now putting it actually in a syringe or a vial. We have been talking for some time. In my 2005 paper on pandemic preparedness and foreign affairs, I talked exactly about the shortcomings of the global vaccine production supply system for influenza, and that if we needed vaccine quickly or that we needed large amounts, we couldn't do that. We're fortunate that this has not been a more severe pandemic. Imagine if, in fact, today H1N1 had a much higher mortality, and a vaccine would be months and months off. Imagine what the world would be like. So we do need to do much more in this way. And there is some, I think, very important developments coming forward in the influenza area. We're seeing more information on universal immunization possibilities, meaning that instead of using the classic seasonal flu vaccine approach of a specific antigen related to a circulating virus, we begin to understand parts of the virus that are stable or that do not change from year to year, from season to season, or from strain to strain, that if we could vaccinate against those, we could potentially vaccinate against a wide range of different influenza types. That is really key if preparing for a pandemic, because that one that we don't expect is very likely the one that could emerge. But if we're covered against a part of the virus that's common to all of the strains, think how important that would be. We need to fund that kind of work even in a more forthright manner and on a global basis. We need to up production capabilities. We can no longer depend on this chicken-egg model, the 1950s approach to growing flu virus vaccine. We need to basically have modern technologies, and we're moving there, but we're still a ways away from that. So I think all of these things collectively really beg for additional support. And, you know, I come back to this time and time again. This is not about just trying to be altruistic or in any way, just we got to do this because otherwise we'll be blamed for not doing it. This is a smart strategic investment in the world's economy. If we can take pandemic influenza off the map by having enough of a vaccine in advance of a pandemic and have the vast majority of the world vaccinated, imagine if we didn't have to deal with pandemics anymore. At least of influenza, that I believe is a sure possibility. And so I am forever encouraged that we're making inroads there, but we need to do much more on a global basis. And I think that clearly is something that at least has gotten more attention now in the last couple of weeks.
Many companies are or have talked about anyway, stockpiling antivirals. And at this point, this novel, H1N1, is sensitive to Tamiflu. But I know that there have been quite a few conversations about, you know, when do you give it to the employee? You know, when do you take it? Do you take it prophylactically? How many courses do you order for each employee? Do you wait until they're sick? And then who dispenses that? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
There are still a lot of questions about that. You know, we do happen to be in the position of having a large strategic national stockpile here for people who are sick to be able to get antivirals. An additional number of doses have been put aside, the number that's still not completely clear, that might even be used in the private sector for prophylaxis, for giving people ongoing drug during a pandemic so that they would stay at work or could stay at work and not get sick at all. It is a confusing situation. When do you tell someone to take the drug? Because if you're wrong, you know, it's not going to hurt the patient any if they're taking it because they now have some other condition that people thought initially were flu. But what you do is you exhaust the supply you have. You basically get one good shot at it. And if you miss and it turns out you really didn't have flu, then you don't have drug for when the flu really comes around. So we do have a lot more work to do. I think that the local and state governments, together with the federal government, have tried to develop means for rapid distribution of the drug to the community. They're looking at different kinds of approaches, whether it's workplace-based, whether it's hospital-based, whether it's a general community support, even the postal service. Those have all been looked at, and what we don't have today, though, is a real comprehensive plan that, for any one area that would says this is how we'll do it. And again, remember that unlike trying to give out antibiotics, for example, after a potential anthrax exposure where you need to get everybody in the community on it at one time, if an influenza pandemic unfolds over weeks to months, when you get that illness may be weeks to months different than when somebody else gets it. And so it's not just distributing the drug one time and then hoping everybody will hold it till the time they need it. It's probably likely going to be trying to disseminate it throughout the entire course of the pandemic, and that's going to be complicated. So when do you get your chance? How do we know that you got your chance? How do we know that you really did it right, meaning you used it against the right influenza strain? Those are all complicated issues for which we really don't have answers yet.
Right. So it's, you know, actually it seems like, really, I tell people the more I know, the more I don't know.
You know what? That gives me real confidence in you, and I mean that sincerely. I give lectures today on influenza in which I state, and I've never had to do this before in my career, that I have a conflict of interest here that I need to disclose. And that conflict of interest is with myself because I know less about influenza today than I did 10 years ago. And therefore, you may want to take anything I say in that light because God knows what I said today, how much of it's really going to be true 10 years from now. And I think one of the things we're realizing that this is a much more complicated bug. Mother Nature has many more tricks up her sleeves than we realize with influenza, and the more we learn, in many cases, the less we know. I think that's a great start, though, to really learning about something. It's when you have that needed sense of humility that says, boy, there's a lot more to learn about this thing. We realized a lot of it was dogmatic responses of, you know, past decades. This is what flu does. This is how it does it. This is what we need to do to stop it. Once we realize we don't know these things, I think we're only going to get better and better at understanding what we do know and how do we better prepare for the next pandemic.
There's also been some work done on antibodies, but I think that's sort of a limited effect, no?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I keep coming back to, you know, just think about if every time there was a news report out there that we suddenly had this new breakthrough technology for influenza or any other infectious disease and you got a nickel for it each time, you and I could go out and have a wonderfully expensive dinner tonight in almost any restaurant in the world. You know, these breakthrough technology announcements occur all the time, but there are several problems with this. One is many cases they don't pan out to be true. Second of all is you got to be able to provide the product. Today we have many products that are thousands and thousands of dollars a dose for certain conditions because they are drugs that are rarely used. There's been big investment up front to do the research to actually support the licensure, and then there's the distribution. And so, yeah, we could use monoclonal antibodies potentially against flu, but well, how practical is that on a worldwide basis? It's not. Surely, from an economic standpoint, there are very few people that could afford to get these. So I think that what we have to take a step back at and look at is what's practical, what's useful, what really will make a difference. And I think that next time we hear about one of these, oh my gosh, amazing new breakthroughs, just take a step back and ask yourself, how practical is this? And what it would really mean. And I think in many times, if you do that, you have a very different sense of what it really means.
There's also some talk about, you know, redirecting some of the existing drugs that are out there that are approved for other illnesses or other the treatments for other things, and relooking at some of those things, generics, over-the-counters, and saying maybe if we're caught without enough vaccine or enough antivirals, these might have some appropriate use, maybe to take the edge off, or at least as far as collateral damages is concerned, people will have something to give their loved ones or to go and pick up at the clinic, as opposed to maybe having nothing or being long down the line in a list to get a vaccine.
Right. You know, there's been a fair amount of discussion about that. Dr. David Fedzin, who has really championed this on a worldwide basis, it says, you know, the statins or any number of different drugs, there very well would be drugs that could have a beneficial effect against severe influenza. You know, and I think that some of the data that Dr. Fedzin has put together has been very interesting and, if not, outright convincing. But I think we still have a lot of questions about what will be the influenza that we'll tackle. Will it be one like an H5N1 where there appears to be some complicated processes going on between the virus and the human, say, versus the annual flu viruses that we see right now? There's big questions about the timing and how much would you need of it and how would you use it. So I think in general, it's something surely we want to explore, and it's something that if these drugs could be of benefit, of course, we definitely want to use them. I do worry, however, that people will then conclude that, well, you know, we already got all the drugs we need out there. We just will take this or that. We'll take aspirin, you know, and go to bed and wake up in the morning fine. And so we want to kind of balance this. We want to surely look at these things, but we know that antivirals against influenza can be very effective if taken early against virtually all the strains out there now that are not resistant. We know that vaccine is all the ultimate answer. I wouldn't want for a moment to put my emphasis on these non-standard drugs because they're cheaper than large-scale investment in vaccines, because in the end, vaccines provide an almost absolute kind of protection where these drugs are still unknown just exactly what they'll do. So yes, we need to look at them, but please don't let that get in the way of this other kind of work that we've been talking about.
If you were talking to a group of mom and dads, neighbors, what would you tell people, you know, what would you tell them to do now? What would you say, okay, you know, the WHO has declared a 5, it looks like this wasn't quite, you know, the big bad one yet. We don't know what, you know, what we're looking at in the fall and then going into next winter. What would you tell people on, you know, in the United States? And then, you know, you are a leader in the world in this in these issues. What would you tell people in the world, you know, what should the regular person do?
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I'm not sure that's necessarily true, but let me take a stab at this. First of all, one of the things I would continue to remind people is that pandemic influenza can be mild, moderate, or severe. And in fact, a moderate pandemic, which means widespread transmission but moderate illness, still can cause a lot of hurt and pain. And that depending on how governments respond, it can surely cause great disruption of global supply chains. So you know, H1N1 really hasn't done those kinds of things yet, but that, please don't use that as the model to say this is exactly how everyone will unfold. So we do have to be prepared. I mean, just because you have a series of minor earthquakes in California, people say, well, that's all it's going to be. We don't have to worry about the big one. That's not the case. They still worry that one day the big one's going to come, and so all the planning that goes into, you know, basically trying to earthquake-proof buildings and so forth is really important. And I would say the same thing is true about transmission of influenza virus into humans that will have more severe pandemics. So we have to stay prepared. We have to keep working on that. What does that mean to the average citizen? Well, it does mean, what would you do if you ran out of some of these critical products that you need, your drugs or your food and so forth, and how would you support yourself? That's not scaring people. That's not trying to, you know, somehow instill this fear that will never be realized, as some people would suggest it might be. These are real events that could happen. I think the second thing that I would talk about is the global nature of our economy today. And I find it difficult that we continue to emphasize how we're going to protect Americans from this virus, when in fact so many of the critical products and services we need are made in developing world countries around the world. You can't use a ventilator today without a thing called a circuit, the thing that attaches you to the ventilator. They're all made outside of the United States, and today that's the big piece that's short in our use of ventilators. And if we suddenly have countries around the world, particularly Mexico and Asia, where these circuits aren't made, we're not going to have any ventilators being used. The drugs I mentioned earlier, etc. So we need to take a much more global perspective on this, and it is not just about being a good Samaritan, a humanitarian person, to say we want vaccine for the developing world too. Frankly, it's very smart. And we've not had that discussion. We need to take care of the world if we're going to take care of ourselves. And finally, I think the last thing I would just say is that there is much we can do now to better prepare ourselves by just being willing to talk about this and walk through these things. And, you know, this idea that everybody will panic when we give them bad news, I don't believe that. The real good risk communicators like Peter Salmon don't believe that either. And yet we find ourselves so reluctant to talk about something. We don't want to go to phase six because the world will panic, which I don't believe is the case at all. And I think we just need to do a lot more around risk communication. That also, by the way, really reflects back to this, the very effort that you're doing. And, you know, we have so appreciated SIDRAP here, the work that you do, because we've gotten many of our really good tips about what's happening in the flu world from people such as yourself. And what we need to do is understand that the world's media is in free fall, that the print media that we have so counted on over the years is basically imploding. And that's really the infrastructure of the good reporters, the good editors. And when that happens, we also have to be very skeptical about this explosion of information on the web as to how good it is. And so I think one of the things I'd tell people is be cautious about the information you get, and also be cautious about what it means. In that regard, know your sources. You know, who are the reporters out there? Who are the sites, the websites that are giving us the best information? And we urge that that citizens have a better handle on that so that they know who to believe when all these stories are out there floating around.
Right. It was pretty incredible, some of the stories that were flying out there. It was kind of astonishing, actually.
It was. Well, you know, even in some of our major venues, the lack of really good reporters today, you know, all the seasoned health reporters have basically either gotten their walking papers or at least early retirement. And the same thing is true with editors. There's a major news venue in this country where on that first Thursday morning of the pandemic unfolding, they interviewed me about the fact that why had governments been so slow to respond to this emerging catastrophe? You know, how could they have let this get like this without us being more responsive? This is on Thursday. The following Monday, they came and interviewed me and said, well, I'm sorry to bother you again, but my editor wants me to do this story. You know, why did governments blow this so out of proportion? Why, you know, they scared us for nothing. This is turning out to be a yawner. Now, that was 4 days difference with the same reporter, the same major venue from, you know, this kind of what I'd call almost, you know, up and down dizziness that occurs. So we've got to do a better job in the media. And I think that that's where, as I said, we follow your group very carefully because we think that you have provided some incredibly reliable information. And we need the public to understand where can they get good information and what does it mean.
Great. I want to talk about what you do at your organization, SIDRAP.
Mm-hmm.
And your web address is, of course, cdrap.umn.edu. Do you want to tell us about what you do there?
Yeah, SIDRAP, which actually is CIDRAP, stands for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. And this was actually formed in the fall of 2001, just before 9/11. And it was actually really an attempt to bring together what I would call kind of the hardcore research of infectious diseases along with the policy development and application of infectious diseases. You can have all the good information you want, but if you can't basically blend that into policy, what have you really accomplished? And so what our job is to try to take this information and make it consequential, make it really have an impact on the lives of our population out there. And so what we try to do is identify topics or issues of major public health importance for which we really haven't developed the policies or the procedures or the overall response plan for what to do. And, you know, bioterrorism was one that we were very involved with, community-based preparedness, pandemic influenza. It's all of these kinds of things that we don't really want to take the time to think about how do we better prepare, because it's never going to happen. But then when it happens, like an earthquake or a hurricane or a tsunami, of course, everyone comes back and says, why weren't we better prepared? So we've spent a lot of time in those areas of trying to really work with governments. We work a lot with the private sector. You know, as goes the private sector in many of these situations, so goes everything else. You know, we like to think that, you know, government can somehow make everything happen if we need to, but they can't make the food, they can't make the drugs, they can't deliver those products, and that's what we've been really working on, is that piece there.
We also have, I think, food security.
We work a lot in food biosecurity. Mm-hmm. We've worked on those kinds of bigger picture issues that are not easy to understand or get your arms around. Sometimes I think some of the issues we tackle are a lot like trying to hug a cactus. You know, it's not always comfortable. But it's things that ultimately we believe will be needed down the road. I mean, it was interesting because for the past several years, after the initial H5N1 situation kind of wore off of everyone, you know, people have been yawning. Why get more prepared for pandemic influenza? You know, it's not going to really happen. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I have been the subject of columns out there or radio talk show hosts where I'm just a scaremonger. You know, I'm one of these people out here that we just want to scare people, and that's not it at all. We want to scare them. We want to scare them into their wits, not out of their wits. And I think that's a piece that people understand. And you never hear these critics come back after the crisis happens. I mean, they just shut up and blend into the woodwork, but that doesn't help you if we're not prepared.
Right, of course. And, of course, then you're probably a firm believer in this concept of shared responsibility.
Absolutely. I think that's very, very important. And, you know, we're very supportive of that approach.
Right, and that's the approach where, you know, like you just said, the government can do only, you know, they can do what they're going to do, but basically it's down to each individual to take responsibility for natural disasters or, which is also pandemic influenza, but whatever comes along, you know, you can't just wait around and wait for
I think there are things that government can and must do. You and I cannot go out and make vaccines. Okay, mm-hmm. We can't.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? We can influence our health plans for mm-hmm. those of us that have the good fortune to have health care in such a way as to how can we stockpile critical drugs? What can we do about that so that we don't have a crisis during a pandemic where people can't get life-needing drugs? What can we do to work with local communities? So if there are resources available, how do they get fairly allocated? You know, that not all of us can get everything we want, but how can we make sure that there's fair allocation? What can we do to make sure that good scientific decisions versus political decisions get made during a pandemic? I have been one of those saying that never close the borders. You know, trying to keep influenza out of a country is kind of like trying to protect a submarine with screen doors. You know, it's going to leak in. I don't care how intensive you put your barrier around that country, whether it's thermal screening or just denial of trade and travel, the influenza virus is going to get in there. And it's not about yes or no. It's about, you know, how can I just reduce the risk of it? Well, if we do that, that may allow us to maintain some of this critical product movement out there, so the needed drugs we need or all the other needed services, even something as simple as syringe and needles, we're going to move those out of places like Asia to our country, and hopefully we in turn have things to move back to Asia. If we don't do those kinds of things, we just hunker down, the consequential damage that's going to occur is going to be really, really major. And as I've called it, collateral damage kinds of events will occur where people will suffer more from the impact of the flu virus on our economy than the individual per se. And that's what we really need to work on a lot.
Right. I think a lot of people who live in Florida, who lived in Florida in the 2004 hurricane season, really got a taste of what really happens to your infrastructure when you have a disaster like that come through every other week for, you know, a month,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
a month and 6 weeks.
Exactly.
And, you know, in my area, we did not see anybody in fatigues or anybody doing anything for 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I live in a suburb of Orlando. So
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and this is with tons of resources flying into Florida from all over the country, even Canada. And so if you can imagine, you know, that in a situation where you have multiple areas that are not able to come and help you, you need a couple of weeks of, some canned goods, you need prescription drugs. We talk about having a group of friends that you could rely on if you don't have, they're picking up some water for everybody, or, what happens to the, water plants if they run out of some of their parts, and, little things that can happen that, you said after a sustained amount of time, this system starts to break down a little bit.
It does. And I must say that one of the conundrums I've had in trying to deal with this issue is that all the things you just detailed are just right on the mark. Those are the things we should have. When you're dealing with an economy like we have today in this country, and frankly for the whole world, it's even more of an acute issue, is there aren't a lot of people that can afford to stockpile weeks of food or medicine, because they can't even afford today to have food on a day-to-day basis. And so that one of the things we have to really look carefully at is how do we help support everyone when only a limited number of people will be able to stockpile these items. And I still believe stockpiling and maintaining those stockpiles will be very helpful to society in general, because the fewer people you have that are going to need a very scarce commodity during a crisis is just that much margin of safety you have for what stock you do have left for the rest of the population that otherwise couldn't afford to stockpile it. So I'm very strongly supportive of that, but I'm also very aware of the fact that there will be those that say, don't come to me and tell me to stockpile my drugs. I can't even afford my drugs now. Don't tell me to stockpile food. I can't even afford to put enough food on the table every day for my family. And that's a conundrum that I don't have an answer for, but at least it's one that when we give this message of stockpiling, we do have to be sensitive and aware of that we're basically creating the haves and the have-nots. But I think having more haves is still better than not, in the sense that when we do have those shortages, there'll be fewer of those people in the lines needing those critical products.
I know that the federal government has reached out to organizations. Some of them are faith-based, community-based, because of that exact reason, so that groups of people share the resources that they have in a particular area, so that haves are sharing with the have-nots on a voluntary basis. Because, again, I don't know if the federal government, in an emergency of this kind, would be able to feed everyone in the country simultaneously and instantaneously.
You're absolutely right, and I think that's one of the things where I give great credit to HHS over the past several years. They have done a good job, and Secretary Leavitt was right at the forefront of that, talking about why stockpiling is critical, and that government was not here to excuse its obligations, but to say there's no way they could meet these kind of obligations, and therefore you yourself had to help take on that responsibility when you could. And I think that's a very important point, and one that we have to really emphasize.
Right, that's great. Well, it's been, I don't know, you said you would give us 30 minutes, and I'm not sure if you can stay longer.
Yeah, actually I do. I have a meeting here that's already started, but I didn't want to interrupt this, because I sure appreciate the opportunity to be with you. And I want to give you guys credit for what you're doing. I think that, the work that you're doing, again, is something that we think very highly of. And I know that when times get tough, like they did in the past few weeks, even groups like ours look to you for what kind of information you're generating and the kinds of things that you're developing, and we give you great credit for that. I think you've been a real public service.
And you're listening to America's Web Radio. Sharon, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with you.
Okay.
All righty. And we're glad to have you listening in. This was a special edition of the Infectious Disease Hour here on Radio Sandy Springs. Hope you enjoyed that. Very interesting. And like I said, we'll have Sharon back on momentarily. Right now, we'll take a couple of make a couple of quick announcements. If you didn't get to hear Edie Hill this morning, she'll be back on Thursday.
Edie Hill joins America's Web Radio every Tuesday and Thursday morning from 8 a.m. till 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Edie talks about current topics stemming from both her own interests and topics sent in by you, the listener. Send questions to ediehill@americaswebradio.com and listen for answers every Tuesday and Thursday on America's Web Radio.
And again, it is America's Web Radio, and we've got, I wonder if I mess that up. Let's see if I mess that up. I probably did. All right, we'll transfer this and, oh, some of the things I do when I'm not thinking. Anyway, we've got one heck of a little storm going on here right at the moment. But we also have Sharon on the phone. Sharon, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Good. Well, that was fascinating, and I hope a lot of people got to tune in and listen to it. And if not, we'll replay it again on Monday, as a matter of fact.
That's great. He's has been one of the leaders in pandemic awareness and preparedness for years, probably one of the original people, along with, you know, Gretchen Woodson, who made the manual, the home treatment manual for influenza that everyone should have a copy of. These guys have really been at the forefront talking about this and, you know, as Dr. Osterholm said, you know, sort of getting some a little bit of flack back for it a little bit.
Yeah, I want to make something clear, and we both know. I obviously I don't. Did you know this doctor prior to today, basically, or?
Did I know it prior to today?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, obviously you did. I didn't. Dr. Woodson, I've been talking to now for 4 years. But I want to make something perfectly clear, and I know that we've both said it many times in the past, but it bears saying again and again and again. We have never yelled, screamed, nor have we ever had anyone on here, to my knowledge, that has yelled and screamed that the sky is falling.
No.
What you do, what our guests have done, is said, look, there is more than a likelihood that we're going to have a big problem. We don't know when. We don't have crystal balls. We're not soothsayers. We don't burn incense to get our ideas or anything else. All we have ever said is, look, we know that it's coming. We don't know when. But no matter what the situation is, it's always good to be prepared, be it for a hurricane, a tornado, a terrorist attack, no matter what it is, it's a good idea to be prepared. And certainly the pandemic. You know, the kicker is, and there was a little fluttering of the leaves with the H1N1, you know, recently, and people sort of paid attention, and then that went away very quickly. But the fact is, and I'm certainly 102 years older than you are, but in my, we've never really had a pandemic like what was faced in 1918. And yes, we have had world pandemics since then, but again, never the severity, never the mortality rate that the 1918, nor what potentially, and that's the key word, potentially, we could have with the H5N1. But we have never yelled or screamed the sky is falling, and that's why flu trackers is so vital to keeping track of what's going on individually, as well as for your neighborhood, as well as for your community and on up the chain, is that you just feed information as to what's happening. And so I wanted to say that one more time.
Because many of our participants are experts in their fields, and that is why they use these little names, you know, the little little moniker names, because, you know, this is something, they're all volunteers, they're doing it out outside their work, and maybe their work is in a profession that is immunology or something related to that, and so we continue to let them use their names. It'd be like someone who has a pen name that they write in, and then they have, you know, their
they're a little sillier than Mark Twain, I must say.
Huh?
A lot of them are a little sillier than Mark Twain, but, you know.
Well, I'm going to read you my list now, because I know this is the time to do it.
I always get so excited. I know. I get so excited.
But these are humanitarians that donate their thousands of hours all over the world and provide this vital information that Dr. Osterholm was referring to. Anne, Alert, Amish Country, Alaska Denise, Lou, Common Ground, Kanika, Dutchie, David Fetson, Florida Medic, Frenchie Girl, Farmer, Ganderspiel, Hawkeye, Hornblower, Einar Hopper, Kent Nickel, Kiwi Bird, Jay Jackson, Jeremy, El Monte, Lely, Neiman, Laidback Al, Nico, Muscade, Mixon, ModTech, Revere, Nurse Naltz, Sophia Zoe, Shiloh, Snowy Owl, Supernova, Snickelfricks, Shannon, Science Teacher, Sharp, Teresa 42, Thornton, Trayfish, The Doctor, Thebes, Trish Pack, Yield Dude, Vibrant 62, Wet Dirt, and Sakermis. For instance, Sakermis was just posting original Turkish articles from Turkey about what's going on there. You know, this is as a volunteer. So, you know, it's really quite something else. Supernova is from Japan, and, you know, we have volunteers from all over the world that are providing information to us that is, you know, turns around and is disseminated to all kinds of people that use it for all kinds of information for themselves personally or to alert their schools or their hospitals. We have lots of healthcare workers that log on and lurk at flu trackers. Sometimes they send me emails about, oh, thank you so much for providing, I didn't know the CDC had this latest interim guidance on X, Y, or Z. So, you know, all of these volunteers are providing all this information and putting it on flu trackers, and it's just really wonderful.
You know, and we literally, and you know this because I sent you the email on it, we have folks listening to this radio show via the Internet around the world. We have a little small fan club in Norway, and Olga. And, you know, it's interesting how we have picked up an audience around the world. And people do listen because they trust you. They trust us that we're giving them good information. We're giving them good guests that know what they're talking about. And we're not blowing smoke about anything.
No, we do our best, and I don't think we're perfect, but
we're not.
We try anyway. Huh?
Since when? I thought
I'm
we were.
I'm going to go ahead and, since we have some time still, just sort of read the stats of what's going on now.
Yeah, please.
Let's see. Everyone's calculating their the H1N1, and I have to tell you, I'm sort of just the numbers. I'm not paying so much attention to the numbers anymore because, honestly, this thing is so easily transmissible and is so asymptomatic in so many people. Although, of course, terribly, we are having some deaths, and some people are getting very sick. It's a very dangerous disease.
Does that seem to be happening in any particular area where the mortality rate or the...
You know,
or
there
the
is no way to know because in some places where they're still testing for it, then you know why this person's having a terrible bronchial problem or such. But at this point, the surveillance is going away on novel H1N1. And so I would say, yeah, it looks like, you know, New York's had a few more cases than other places. But I don't know what's been going on in Oregon today exactly. And I can't tell you because they don't know. This thing is, you know, it's now going to rip through the populations, the world. For most people, it's a fairly mild illness. We're never really going to know how many people got it. We may not even really know how many died. CDC reported 10 in the U.S. to date, but there's really 12. And do we think 12 is all of them? Probably not. You know, maybe not.
Sure not.
But the numbers are, I'll read you the numbers, but I have to say that, you know, the numbers are, WHO is reporting a grand total of 13,000 as of this morning in the world, with half that being in the United States. But maybe because our surveillance might be a little bit better than some other countries.
Yeah, you've got me a bit concerned now. you're saying that we've lowered our boxing gloves a bit, surveillance.
On H1N1.
Okay, well, that's my question, though. Come fall, come August, September, if this has mutated and picked up a strain and becomes the carrier of the H5N1, if we've lowered our surveillance of the H1N1, but it changes, is the surveillance going to be there adequately enough and quick enough to pick up that, oops, we've got the bad one now?
Well, I guess, you know, really, no. I mean, we're not watching, you know, there's not enough test kits in the world to test for all the things we probably should be watching for. You know, our first clue with most things is like in Mexico when some people started getting very ill and you couldn't quite figure out what that was because it didn't fit a pattern. You know, everyone's watching H5N1. There's certain hot spots in the world that are being watched, certainly, very closely by WHO and those member countries. But H1N1 itself, most countries don't have enough people and enough test kits to test everyone who may have had a headache for 2 days, for instance. So, you know, a lot of that surveillance is not going to be going on just simply because the people aren't going to be reporting themselves as being that sick, and then who's going to test people that are healthy? They're not even able to test everyone who's sick. So, you know, we can't be looking at following H1N1 into the fall specifically to find out if a pandemic is developing. That's not going to work.
Well, it's a scary situation, isn't it?
Well, not so much. I mean, already you had to know that this thing, it was not the 65% case fatality rate that the world average of H5N1 is.
Right.
So you knew that, and then it was so easily transmissible. You know, to try and count that as it, you know, sweeps through the billions of people on the earth, it's undetectable in many people. So, you know, now what we have to do is continue to do all the normal surveillance in the world that all the organizations are doing. Watch for what we're going to be doing at Flu Trackers is watching for abnormal trends and diseases. It's probably going to be called something else when it breaks out. It's going to be called atypical pneumonia. It might be called typhoid, dengue. We don't know. So we're watching all those diseases. And so we're not the only ones. You know, a lot of the World Health Organization is watching all those. So, you know, what you have to look for is a trend in general disease. And that's going to tell you if we're looking at something much more dangerous than we've got now. But, you know, people are already looking for a return of the flu coming in the fall in the Northern Hemisphere. They're going to be watching for what it's going to be doing.
I just started to say, do you think we have now, here it is, the end of May, have we gone into the quiet before the storm?
You know, I don't think H1N1 goes away. I think that it's in the communities, it's in the populations. It's going to be less apparent in the Northern Hemispheres, as at least in North America, school lets out. A lot of people take the summer to do other things. A lot of clubs and organizations don't meet regularly.
We just about got zapped by a...
Why'd you get zapped?
Yeah, we just about got zapped by a big bolt.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still on the air. So
H1N1 is not going away. It's just going to be in some parts of the world less apparent than it was. But it's there. It's out there. It's infecting people. It's mixing and matching genetically with other things. And, you know, the surveillance is almost impossible because it's so pervasive at this point. And we just watch for general disease trends as we go forward. Could it pick up some avian components of H5N1? Sure.
Well, it already has some.
Tomorrow or next week or next month or the fall or next year.
Let me ask, do you know, and again, I know you're not a doctor of this, but since this H1N1 did have an avian flu portion to it, is there any way that, do you know if that can develop into a stronger
H1N1?
That's
a very interesting question. Everyone I've asked doesn't know. Yes, that's a very interesting question.
A lot more questions than answers.
Well,
still.
Like we talked about,
yeah.
I know less than I've ever known. I have just way more questions than I know anything. I feel like I don't know anything, barely.
and probably can find people that could give you answers, a bunch of different answers to the same question.
Well, no one knows. No one yeah. knows the fact that this has a part avian component. What does that mean when it meets up with avian H5N1, and does that make it easier for it to pick up those avian parts of H5N1 as a genetic code? Nobody knows.
Right.
I think people will guess, but no one actually really knows.
Well, my concern is that we get the answer to that later than we need to. But like the doctor said, the situation of a vaccine, no matter when we find out, is still literally months and months and months away. You can't do it overnight. You can't do anything overnight. And
I think one of his most important points was that we have to not just worry about what we're doing in the industrialized countries It is selfish. I mean, that's my words, not what he said. It's selfish and greedy, honestly. But what he said was that we have to worry about what's going on in the world, because the world is us. You know, it disease-wise, economically. So if we're only concerned about what's going on in North America, then, and we're not concerned about helping people in Africa and helping people in some other places that need assistance, you know, it's going to it's us. It's where we are, and it's happening to us at the same time. So
well, I think though you got it. In all fairness, you got to take it as a juggler and have to address each situation as it presents. I don't think you can say, well, we should leave all of our Tamiflu in Africa, or we should leave all of our supplies here, there, or whatever. I think yes, and I agree that we are the world, but at the same token, we also have a responsibility to ourselves, and it's sort of like, you know, you can't give away the farm and not expect some consequences. So is it more important that we stay and do our thing, or is it that you try to cut it off? If we can stop it in a third world country or something, if we can stop it there, well, certainly that benefits us as well. But at the same token, if it's done as much as it's going to do there, and we have to take care of ourselves because it's important for us to keep producing, then we have to. I think, you know, it can't be called. It has to be on a presentation basis.
Well,
my
if
opinion.
We don't take care of those less fortunate than us, we aren't taking care of us either.
Well, again, it has to be on a presentation basis, I think. We don't know. I mean, nobody knows. That's just like you said. There seem to be more questions being asked than conceivably answers can be given, and there's no crystal ball on this or any of the viruses, I suppose.
No, but what we do know is that a lot of viruses have a birthplace in Africa, potentially. Some diseases do. At least they seem to get out of control there, where we notice them more. And, you know, if we don't pay more attention to that, that's not good for anyone.
Well,
not anybody
it's
Africa, not anybody in Europe, not anybody in the North Pole.
Sort of like Mexico, though. We weren't expecting it to come out of Mexico, exactly.
Well, we don't. You know, honestly, we don't know that it came out of Mexico. It's just that it was discovered
it appears
in Mexico.
To have. Right.
How do we know? Nobody knows where that came from. It's just that it was discovered there. It may have come out of the United States. It might have come out of who knows where.
Yeah.
You know, it's fairly mild in a lot of people. So this thing could have been hanging around for months and months. And it could have come from someplace totally different.
Well, with that being said, it's time that we've got to go on to the next show. And we will. What we'll do on this, we'll go ahead and archive it tomorrow. And then for sure it will play in our regular time slot on Monday at 4 o'clock. But in the interim, we'll try to get it on the air a couple of other times.
Great.
And try to catch people that just happen to be tuning in. And once again, thanks for setting it up, Sharon, with Flu Trackers. If you want the latest up-to-date information, go to flutrackers.com, and there you'll find it. So I hope y'all are getting over the rain down there?
No, it's raining and raining, and we're having a storm right now.
So are we. So with that being said, we're going to go on, and we will talk to you on, next week sometime.
Okay, great.
Okay, thanks, Sharon.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.